Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hemp Association. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about the opportunity to build a relationship and connect this supply chain. I mean, after all, that's why we started the association. Our association was built on the foundation of connecting supply chain, building relationships, and helping you grow your business. Anyone from farmers, manufacturers, and distributors, people that are passionate about the supply chain, and those creating products selling into biofuels, plastics, textiles, construction, and building materials.
I really want to turn it over. Maren, thank you again very much for joining me. I'm very excited to have you. You want to give a quick intro about kind of who you are and what you've been up to in this industry?
Sure. Thank you so much, first off, Mandy, for having me. This is really special, and you're totally right. It's been a while that we've actually been in contact, and I kept turning you down, going like, I need to finish this work. And now I think it's both of us, right? We're both holding a copy of it. The H is for hemp. There you go.
I'm so proud of it. I literally carry it with me everywhere. And so it's definitely getting used.
Now that's very special to hear. But before we actually dive into the whole back end of the bookmaking and everything, let's do the introduction. So my name is Maren Krinks. I'm a German climate impact storyteller, photographer, have definitely ventured on to also be an author and a writer. And I have been researching the rediscovery of industrial hemp for the past 6 years, which came about a little bit as an accident. I was actually out to search for a different story, and then that hemp plant just kept crossing my path. And eventually I got so interested and also so fascinated by all the potential that this plant has that I decided to make a whole book on it. And the book actually got published in March of this year, and the opening of the whole book tour, which literally just ended this week, was in the US, and this is where I met Mandy personally at NOCO in Denver, Colorado. Real pleasure. And
it's so nice seeing another tall woman. I loved standing next to you when you walked in the room. I was like, hey girl, I see you.
True that. That was one of my first words. You really impressed me. This was the first time in a long time I had to look up to look into another woman's eyes.
and getting to know everybody on Zoom like this is very different. I stand up and so many people are like, wait, what? I love it. Okay, so I'm curious, when you got into this, what were you on the search for? And what was that aha moment for you that really said, you know, like, whoa, hemp is something I need to redirect and focus on?
Yeah, I actually, when I set out, I moved into my car in the beginning of 2016, and I wanted to venture through Europe and kind of get to know a little bit more about my own home grounds and also find out a bit more what was triggering the refugee crisis at that point. And yeah, as said, whatever I touched, wherever I came, the hemp plant sort of intersected my pathway. And pretty quickly, I started realizing that hemp can actually address a lot of these issues that are, let's say, some of the sources for the refugee crisis, you know, missing a lack of political voice, a lack of safety, a lack of housing, work, networks, education. There's all these things, and you know, when basically it was my Italian friend Werner Schönthaler, who actually was also the person to introduce me in to this whole hemp world. He does hemp building materials, and I think it was into knowing him for a couple of months, and he said this one sentence to me, and he said, "Maren, I work with hemp because this plant fascinates me. It can feed, dress, shelter, heal, and did I forget anything? I don't think so. Humanity." And so here I was, you know, I had the whole sort of pitch line standing why I would be interested in hemp myself and how this could actually also be used to mitigate the climate crisis, to move on a little bit further from the refugee crisis, which then was a topic. Obviously, now it's becoming a topic again. Mm-hmm. And so really, it was a humanitarian interest that I took in the plant.
I'll tell you what, that's where it's hit me. And I'm a little embarrassed to say I was not well connected to my humanitarian side or to the understanding of how removed I was and how disconnected I was, right? And so I feel like hemp is what's really drawn that connection for me. And to say we have an opportunity to make a major impact. And, you know, coming back to its impact on the climate crisis, can you kind of talk to me about what you found in your journey as maybe what are some of the aha moments you had that you didn't expect to where hemp has really played a positive or impact or will play an impact, a significant impact?
Sure. I think, you know, most of us who at one point started working with hemp and had no idea, I think we all at one point started at the as the typical greenhorns, which I would have called myself definitely in 2016. And it was, of course, you know, when you move into to dealing with a plant or first hearing about it, it's kind of all these things that hemp can be used for: plastics, clothing, building material, food, medication. These things kind of strike our interest at first, but I think this is not necessarily where it ends. This is maybe the instant gratification that we get from our more capitalistic world, but
I'm a little bit critical here. And really, it goes back to like, how do we connect that dot? Because in the past, it has not been appealing for capital, you know, moving capital when we start talking about sustainability because of the cost, because of the expense or the lack of profitability that has come. I think that's changing. I think
that actually, you just pitched me a wonderful ball. Let's start that conversation maybe a little different, because if we go back way back when, you know, to times when our planet was not as overpopulated as it is nowadays, and maybe also not as modernly run as it is nowadays with cars and skyscrapers and all that, indigenous populations were using hemp all the time. Bows and arrow were made out of it. The hemp fiber was used for either clothing or, you know, anything that was sacks or ropes, shipping. I mean, we know, obviously, within the hemp industry, we know all that history of hemp. So we also know that history dates back literally 12,000 years. I mean, Vikings were discovered in their graves that the most precious thing that they were holding were the hemp seeds. So I think hemp really has that long-standing history with humanity, and if we look back, we see also how humanity sort of fell out of its intrinsic connection to nature, which is, you know, everything has become very digitized, and that's not only good, but it's also not only bad. I think we need to see all these shades of gray in between the opposite ends. But for one thing, I will say that hemp to me definitely was one of these compasses back to nature, where I started, you know, following this plant beyond the products and beyond these things that we like to think and handle and deal with. I started discovering things like phytoremediation. Hemp can clean up soils. Wow. That can be a major, you know, source of actually healing, but also reducing all these problems that come from soil pollution, soil, I will say, contamination and even depletion, because how are we going to continue feeding a growing world population if our soils are not soils anymore, but actually either garbage dumps or even just, you know, wasteland where nothing grows in. So,
well, and I think we're seeing that, you know, this is where we come back to what's impacting us directly. And, right, you know, it is now no longer a distant problem or a problem in the future for what's happening to our soils or our lack of ability to produce a profitable crop in our hometowns with the best water systems and the best, you know, let alone areas where we don't have irrigation and we don't have extra resources. I mean, it's just,
I think there's a lot of these, you know, connected benefits. I mean, obviously, we all also know that hemp doesn't need any of the herbicides and pesticides. So being able to grow a plant that will be able to replenish our soils at the same time as it doesn't tap into all of what we're doing wrong right now, which is all these, you know, overbred crops that need so much of the chemicals, water, and all these things to grow. And so there's this part that, but then there's also this part of, you know, going back to the roots. We used to use hemp paper. Hemp paper has vanished. It has disappeared. Obviously, I know that many who are following us now have heard about the whole hemp story or the whole hemp paper story of my book, where I actually went out to develop a hemp paper specifically for this book. But it was a really difficult undertaking. And obviously, the price of the paper is, you know, let's say not so attractive that it will be immediately.
What is it? What are you looking at? You know, going out and looking for paper to publish on in big volumes, right? Where are you dollar for dollar, and where, you know, when you're comparing?
Well, if I'm comparing, I mean, I can only speak about the photography world right now because that's where I'm coming from. I've published my 4 books, so I do have the comparison values there to other papers. And photography papers for book publishing are always expensive. We're always on the higher end. And if I take the hemp paper in comparison, then we're actually looking at a 19 times higher price, which is one of the reasons why the book is so horribly expensive, which I know is a lot of the reason why many people are kind of holding off to get it. And, you know, that's also why we said we're going to make a limited edition of this book. So it's signed and numbered. There's only 700 copies available because this was basically what we were able to do on the hemp paper.
You guys, the pictures, I'm the most impressed with how clear and nice the pictures are in it. Like, it printed so clear. I want to show everyone.
Awesome.
My camera does not even do it justice. And it's just, yeah.
I'm glad you're mentioning it because this was also one of the big parts of the development of the paper. I did it with Hahnemühle, a German paper company who's obviously sort of the top-notch paper company for any artistic specialty papers. And Hahnemühle really took, I think it took us about 2 years in the development phase to really get it to that point where we were able to get the quality of photography being printed on these pages without having too much of a loss in the quality. Because obviously, as a photographer, you always want to have these super crisp and sharp photo prints, which, you know, it's never going to meet the equivalence to like a high-end photographic bookmaking paper that we've been used to, which is done in offset printing. I mean, we still had a lot of technical issues in the printing and everything. But nonetheless, I think that's part of the pioneer work, that you kind of have to come up with something and just do that first step. And I was really grateful also for the entire audience of the book, that there was actually very little people who circled back and kind of made a claim that there might have been a white line or some scrapes on the paper, because we really walked the talk in the full length. I decided to back up from anything that would have made this book a safe undertaking. So I decided no coating on the paper, no coating on the cover even, which is pretty dangerous because obviously this book is being sent worldwide and, you know, any scrape on the paper will definitely leave a big dent. So it was, let's say it this way, it was a lot of risk, and I'm very glad people are walking along with it.
I'm proud of it. Yes, I'm proud to know that you made it and that I was, that I get to shake your hand on it. So I'm excited. Can we dive in a little bit to the book? Talk to me about what were some of the challenges, you know, we talked about the development of paper. What are some other challenges you really came across? And then I'm curious about the people you met along the journey.
Yes, that was definitely one of the highlights. The people I've met along the journey were just, I think, altogether very, very stunning personalities that always came with a big extra in their vita. You know, I will say there was probably always some significant event for everybody why they turned to hemp. And that became sort of that pet peeve for me, because I was always looking for that why. You know, why did you turn to hemp? Because usually it was a very dramatic personal story for many people that either was health related or it was related to business ventures not working out in the common or usual way, and they really wanted to push for something else to happen. That was one of the things. And I think, circling back to your first question about what was most difficult about the book, obviously, this is a very political topic. I mean, we know, unfortunately, that hemp still is not fully legalized in the entire world. When I say hemp, I actually mean industrial hemp, not just cannabis. I mean, cannabis is a whole different story. We'll probably be waiting a couple more years on that to happen. But even industrial hemp, if we look at Norway, it's still not legal there. There are so many countries, Mongolia, for example, I visited. It was very difficult because you're coming there as a journalist on an official mission to document a plant that is highly illegal, and you don't really know how the system is going to treat you. You know, are you going to be basically putting people, but also your own life at stake, just because you're basically getting involved into an illegal topic.
Right. without even touching it. I mean, we see that very briefly here, right, with our banking system. It's very difficult for me to market or to bank or promote certain things because our company says hemp, even though we're not necessarily touching the crop. So, you hear the horror stories that happen where you cross the wrong person or the wrong interpretation is given, and then you're kind of stuck in this legal system on an international, with international courts. And so, I think that would be a...
I think so too. There's definitely so many ins and outs about this, and it becomes, there was this slow progression along the journey, you know, kind of dive in, you know nothing, then you run into the first problem, and you're like, oh, I need to be more careful about this. There's actually some things that I should not be saying in public, or maybe I should not be so open about what I'm actually working on. I mean, there were all these interesting stories that are kind of also collected in the diary entries that I have in the book. You know, I kept being sort of under the surveillance of systems. Like in Iceland, I was being surveyed. Then in Italy, I usually always get surveyed because what I'm doing to them is just not really okay. So the system keeps watching you, you know, when you're going in and out. And it was really funny because I came from documentary photography, where I was always in rather very safe environments and also safe topics. And suddenly it all turned very political. I had to really guard the people I was photographing, the stories I was collecting, the images I was putting in my data bank, you know, extra safety measures and security measures on that. So it was kind of interesting. There was a lot of extras in the making of this book. And then, of course, another thing that was also very important to me was to stay independent during the whole 6 years of working on this book. So you will see that there's a whole category about supporters in the book. I specifically did not call anybody a sponsor because, you know, a sponsor would probably allude people to think that that whoever is a sponsor also took influence on my topics that I'm reporting about in the book. And I was really trying to stay completely independent on that front and really make sure that my reporting is done by me. I do my research and I, you know, try to cross verify everything with as many sources as possible. And yes, I mean, sometimes there were differences in opinion. And then after all, I kind of went with whatever felt right to me from what I could piece together from the international network.
I love it. Okay. So speaking of the network, talk to me about the value of this and the benefits to your network and the importance of developing a network.
Well, the network definitely has a whole chapter, and it's actually the first chapter in the book. The Alpine Hemp chapter is all on networks. And in fact, I honestly think that if any human has a good and standing network in their lives, you're probably pretty much in a safety harbor, because just giving you some examples, like there's very few countries that now I can travel to where I would not have somebody to call, where I can crash on a couch because they became friends or good acquaintances throughout the project. That's one of these things that's really, really amazing, because you realize that this world has turned from a pretty anonymous, huge place where there's so much space that you have no knowledge about, to a very tiny globe that is so interconnected with the people, with the topics. And, you know, just also looking at the political situation in Europe right now with our war in Ukraine going on, I think it really makes all the difference, because if you have these human interconnections globally, it's impossible to think about fighting a war against anybody, because these are your friends, these are your family, these are your network. These are people you rely on, people that circle back to you, but that you also circle back to if you need anything. So I think networks have a very broad, how do you say, scope of peacemaking, of exchanging, of knowledge-based exchanging. I mean, I think
they're the foundation. They're the foundation to our relation to everything, right? And I say this all the time, is it's not what we know, it's who we know. And being able to build a relationship, I'll speak to what you just said. Presenting and interviewing just like this on a regular basis with people all over the world has made the biggest impact, because now I can travel and attend any event or visit. Yeah, traveling internationally or across the US, there are people in every state and every region. And it's even more impactful as we have an emerging industry. You know, we're a small group still. And so... And-
Yeah, and I will say that, Mandy, the work that you do, and I mean, there's obviously more than one hemp association. We have the European Hemp Association. We have you working on global levels. And I hear myself so often in conversations to point these organizations and associations out and say, guys, you need to connect there, because everybody who starts with hemp sort of stands, you know, at the first step of a huge staircase that has so much knowledge involved. And it really works so much easier when you kind of reach out to a network first and make sure you understand the ins and out and all the troubles that come along with planting hemp, with growing hemp, with post-producing hemp into any of the products. And the networks are of such value.
Yeah, totally. And there's huge benefit to, I hear this often out of reservation for people in joining. It's like, well, there's another bank there, or there's another processor or another farmer, where those are the guys we should be rubbing shoulders with, right? Learning from what's worked. When did you outsource? When did you hire? When did you buy equipment versus lease equipment? You know, which seed distributor was best? Do we ship into, you know, the East Coast versus the West Coast?
Right. I mean,
there's so many questions and so many things that you can learn from people that are in your same vertical doing the same thing. And so, yeah, I'm going to second this. And I do see a great comment right here. H is for hemp is what all books will look like in the future.
Yes, I want to hear this and I want to see this. If we can actually make the hemp paper more viable and have more productions being printed on it, that was one of my goals, because I'm still trying. Maybe we have a publisher here online. I'm still trying to find a publisher for the next edition of this book, because I do want to continue printing on hemp. Of course, as you know, a single artist, it's really, really difficult to push that through financially, because it really takes a bit of an extra step. And I've done it on the first level in combination and help with a paper company and also with a printer here in Germany with Elanders. But it definitely takes a strong will and some stepping up the game to do it. But I heard something wonderful in Amsterdam just last week when I had my last book presentation with the Packhaus of Zwijchen, and I had a wonderful hemp farmer, a lady from North Holland, who was on the panel, and she said, once we start actually pricing for all of the carbon emissions that are done by products, but also by the productions, then the pricing of products will completely change. And I think this is something that we really need to strive for.
I 100% agree with you. And I've said this for a little while, so I'm excited to hear that from other people or different perspectives. It's almost like the carbon becomes that subsidy that now we can compete and get off of insurance or get off of subsidies for the crop, you know, side alone, let alone the production is, you know, taking the entire life cycle analysis, not just what the product's being sold for. So, that's good to hear.
And I want to also add that, because I know that you've done your show or your Bruce Dietzen is a fixed part of your team. I know Jeremy Hale is also working with his Drawdown team, whom I got to know better in the United States. There are so many people who are actually working on the carbon credits with hemp. The lady that I mentioned here from the Netherlands also works on it. Then we have Hemp Connect in Germany who are working on this. This is going to be our future, and we really have to kind of buddy up so that all of these initiatives that are working on these programs actually get a common push from everybody, because the hemp industry should collectively be interested in pushing this forward, because it's going to be, well, I say our, but actually I'm not really actively part of the hemp industry. I'm more, interested in the industry. But I think if here we are back to the networks, right? We need to bundle up more effectively, but we also need to keep in mind that we have to keep things local, because this is one of these things, the bigger the networks get and people are so interconnected, and sometimes it just seems more striking to buy I'm making a stupid example, to buy the seeds from a really, really good friend who just happens to sit across the ocean from you. Well, we need to make smarter decisions on that too, because I think if the networks are good, everyone has their stable way of survival. The only thing is we need to also keep it local, so we actually reduce also our carbon footprints.
well in securing the supply chain, right? Otherwise, we end up dependent on other countries and other people, and we'll be right back in this same pitfall that we've been in. And so as bad and as hard as the pandemic has been, it definitely has exposed opportunity for hemp to fix and localize these supply chains, and it becomes pretty exciting. And I have to say, like, I feel like you are part of the industry when you're creating a material or a product to use and drive that supply chain, right? Where I think that's powerful. In fact, one of the most powerful, because that's what impacts the entire life cycle analysis of now being able to start by growing and giving our farmers a reason to grow. And so I do have to say, thank you. As much as it feels like you're watching from the outside, being able to put a book together and come up with, you know, printing paper at scale is pretty awesome. And I would love to help connect you to some publishing groups and organizations. And so I will keep my ears and eyes open. And if anybody on the call knows anybody, please, you know, connect with Maren. Tell me how people get in touch with you.
The best way definitely is my email. So you just take my whole name and put the info at in front of it, info at, and then marenkrings.com. That's literally the best way to get in touch with me. Of course, if you rather have a little, you know, social media, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Instagram, on Facebook. It all goes through my name. And I think I have my picture up everywhere. So whoever sees me here will recognize me on these profiles. I mean, it's definitely, I agree with you when you say that it's not truly that I'm removed from the industry. With the paper development, I definitely took a deep step in there that was probably also not really anticipated from my end. It was literally a must do it because I really tried to walk the talk and become as sustainable as I kept saying we could possibly be with hemp paper and all of this. And then it was just a complete mess to find hemp paper and actually, you know, get the book printed on it.
It's hard sometimes to walk the talk when we're looking at the profitability, right? And being able to compete. Yeah. Like you said, what that did to impact the price or the cost of the book. And so I give this back to the industry. We of all people should be focusing on walking the talk or talking the walk, right? Because we, you know, our opportunity to make an impact as an industry can easily be disrupted with bad practices and, you know, layers of plastic packaging and layers of, you know, things that we actually have solutions for within our industry to drive our industry. And so, yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, so speaking of the book, can you talk to me a little bit about, I've read a lot of it, I've spent a lot of time showing it off. Talk to me a little bit about how the book can be used for those that are in the industry. Right. Talk to me about where is this really intended to be a tool to advance?
Well, I will actually be able to tell you a story that happened. I think it was about 1 month ago. A friend of mine from Italy called me up on WhatsApp. And I think that was while I was still touring in the United States with a book. And he said, Maren, I have to tell you this. So he had gone to a trade fair that was not specifically on hemp, but actually like a body and lifestyle trade fair in Cologne in Germany. And you probably know that we have that issue with the CBD, where they're still trying to sometimes place it into the novel food, and it's very tricky. Unfortunately, law enforcement is not as well educated as they should be. So oftentimes they're still stuck in the old belief of this is illegal, this is, you know, a drug. And it's definitely an issue for everyone who's basically on trade fairs and being a vendor of anything CBD or industrial hemp products. So as he's doing these lifestyle products with, you know, balm and tinctures and all these things, he was standing on the trade fair and then these, I think it was two or three people that would be an equivalent to the FDA in the United States. They came up to him, but they were dressed civil. So he didn't know that they were actually, you know, trying to scout out people doing some stuff that they weren't supposed to do on that trade fair. He gives them the whole intro into the products, talks about CBD, talks about hemp. And then they say, well, you know that we could cuff you up and take you out of here now. And he's like, what are you talking about? And they're like, well, what you're selling is not legal. And he's like, everything I'm doing is legal. And then he realized, they're kind of coming at him because of the CBD. And he obviously had the book. And he, in that spur of a moment, he just turned around. He took the book. He said, give me one chance. Can you please sit down over there on these chairs, read the chapter H is for health, and then you come back and tell me if you still want to cuff me up and take me out of here. So they actually did that, which was great. They took the book.
It gave me the goosebumps. They actually were willing to sit down and do that.
That's yes. Awesome. They actually sat down. They took the book. They read through that whole book, chapter of H's for health. And then they came back, or it was C for cannabinoids. Sorry, that's the health chapter. And then they came back to him and they literally excused themselves for being so unknowledgeable about the topic and said, can we buy the book? This is phenomenal and we need to have the book because this is finally answering us all of these questions that we need to know when we do our job and we want to do our job correctly. So this was always something that I was saying when I was kind of touring through the whole world, talking to so many people from the industry, and I realized how much time everybody is losing by trying to explain in full length and in full scope all of these different topics. I mean, hemp is amazing, but it also gets a complete drawback when you're trying to give the rundown every single time somebody comes up with that. Can I smoke that shirt? Can I smoke that house? Do I get high when I eat this or when I drink the hemp tea, or do I get high when I eat hemp bread or something? It just gets a nuisance and you're losing so much time. And this was always what I had hoped for, that this work, H's for Hemp, is actually going to be used just as an encyclopedia where whatever it is that you need to quickly get across to somebody, you can basically take and say, do B is for building, do, I don't know, W, work and income.
Yeah. So what are some of your favorite topics? So I want to, real quick, right? This is set up like an encyclopedia. You can see here, right? So for those that aren't familiar, it's got tons of pictures, lots of information, lots of different topics. Can you talk to me about what are some of the basic topics or some of your favorite topics that are in here? And then what is probably least expected? Can you give us a little snippet without giving the book away?
Sure.
What we find?
So the book has chapters that basically contain all of the human foundations. And that was kind of what I was addressing in the very beginning with the refugee crisis. So for humanity to be in a sweet spot, meaning not living in poverty, we need to be well off on having housing, education, energy, clean water to drink. We need a political voice. We need food. We need shelter. And all of these basic needs of humanity are basically addressed in the book in one single chapter. Now, we made that a little bit creative. So if you look into the index, you will see things like tree-free, hemp paper, and then comes water. And you kind of go like, what is all this about? Well, it's always intrinsically connected because to make paper, or the paper-making process, is actually 98% consistent of water, which if you look at the end effect is also that, you know, paper making in the conventional ways is quite polluting for the environment. So then the next thing would be D is for drugs, which I connected to the human foundation of peace and justice, which is, you know, that people actually have a safe place, which if you look at the marijuana and hashish production in Morocco, which is something that actually feeds most of these coffee shops here in the Netherlands, it actually comes at a pretty big drawback for humanity in Morocco because those people are not living a good life. And if you see for what the hashish is being bought here in the Netherlands, and I am still here in the Netherlands, then that's a whole different story to what they're experiencing there. So I'm connecting these topics in a very graphic and illustrative way. Of course, there could have been probably 100 other stories that could have told the same issue, but I basically picked from everything that I had experienced and collected over the time of travel. One of the things that might be most unexpected for the industry about this book is that, after all, it is actually an art book. We spend a lot of time and thought into the design and into the structure and layout. It has a very intuitive way of being able to be read. So it's not a book of 624 pages where you will have to be afraid of, oh my God, if I get this book, I'm going to be glued to my couch for the next 3 months.
No, there's like all kinds of great pictures that are, yeah,
Exactly.
Honestly, that's my favorite part about it, is because, yeah.
Well, I think it's also a necessary part, because even within the hemp industry, you know, somebody who works in hemp building might have absolutely no insight or understanding of what the biocomposite and hemp plastic industry has to offer, or how that really looks like. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of people, yeah, you're in the building chapter now. I saw a lot of people who actually, you know, from within the industry went like, oh, wow, this is how the material looks, and this is what you can do from it. Where I was like, wow, I'm really impressed that, you know, I mean, this is why we go to trade fairs, to see all these different products. But usually what we see is the end product. We never get to do a sneak peek behind the scenes of how is this being derived? How is this being processed? What are the ins and outs of that? And, you know, of course, I don't give away any secrets. Recipes or any of the insights that would give away technology that was, you know, protected by the companies that let me visit. But I really try to make it more transparent and also more understandable, because hemp is really huge. And one of the reasons why it is so hard for this industry to make that easy comeback, which is not an easy comeback, is because it is so complex. And when you look at the book, you kind of get the taste for it. It starts with the fact that there are some plants that get up to 1.20 meters. That's it. And then there's the others in Turkey that get literally up to 8 meters. And there's worlds in between that. Or, you know, even machinery for the post-production of hemp or harvest. It is so different. But it really started to dawn on me when I was going to China and to Turkey and to Iceland and Mongolia, how different the development in all of these different, it's one industry, but it's literally like different continents and
languages. Okay, so I want to dive into that, because I'm curious, as you were talking, people versus governments, right? Mm-hmm. That are ahead in the production of this crop or development of materials. Can you talk a little bit about who or where we're seeing both strengths? You know, because I would imagine innovation is very far ahead in some areas where policy may not be, or harvesting may be advanced in a local community, but scale not at all. So I'm kind of curious from you, the people and the policy differences.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming now that probably a lot of our listeners are actually from the United States. So the United States is a perfect example. Here you are, the country, I will say, of cannabis, right? You had the legalization on the good stuff that's so illegal in so many other parts of the world, came back to the United States much earlier than it came in Europe. But at the same time, the freeing up the plant on the industrial level just didn't happen. But you can't really say that there's not a community of a lot of people who are actually interested in pushing this forward. So the question is, why is this not working? I want to give you a different example. Iceland. Iceland is a very small country.
Yeah.
Iceland had a complete ban on anything cannabis, anything industrial hemp until 2019. The reason why I know that so well is because I met one of the, at that point, he was one of the only hemp, I will say ambassadors, because activist always sounds a bit misleading in that context. But yeah. Palmi Einarsson was, or is still, one of the leading hemp ambassadors in Iceland. He was always talking about the plant. He comes from a pure industrial background, used to work in prosthetics. I can't ever say that word right.
Okay. If you're talking about prosthetics, that's right.
And he was basically trying to find something to replace the carbon fiber in that.
Yeah.
And that's already when he came up with hemp. Now, that work took place in the United States. And then he moved back to his homeland in Iceland and kept saying, we need to reintroduce industrial hemp, and we can even grow it in Iceland. People were just shaking their heads going like, it's really illegal. And no way. Right. Hemp's never going to grow in Iceland. Well, eventually, Palmi actually got up. He moved out of Reykjavik, of the capital. He bought a farm and he started planting hemp and set up a unique and very amazing circular system of his hemp farm, using sheep and fish to feed from the hemp seeds and everything. So it was really circularity and the full concept. Now, when he started, because the Icelandic legislation had no real ins and outs on any of the industrial hemp, he was allowed legally to import the industrial hemp seed. But once it was in the country, they decided that that's a drug and that's completely illegal. So for about half a year, it was really at stake if Palmi would have to go to prison, which was horrible. I mean, he has a family, he has two lovely boys. And then it was in, I think in lieu of all of this happening, there was sort of like a growing movement of people interested in legalizing industrial hemp because they also wanted to grow in Iceland that started organizing a hemp, I will say a hemp association. Yeah. I got invited at the end of 2019 to speak on this panel or symposium about industrial hemp. And all I was asked to do was basically bring in all these different stories from all over the world, how hemp is used, for what it's being used and what it's done with it. And obviously the word drug never really hit the stage with me because I didn't have any experiences that I made on the topic of drug. It was all purely industrial hemp being used for very industrial purposes. And there were a bunch of other speakers on that panel. And by the time we were done, I think it was literally 2 weeks later. 2 weeks later, the Icelandic legislation freed up everything. They legalized hemp. Palmi was out of the call of, you know, if this is legal or illegal, what he's doing. And it was an amazing experience. So I think sometimes it's a combination of the time needs to be right. Of course, it always helps when you have small structures, like a huge country like the United States, where I will say, where I will just make that claim, between the East Coast and the West Coast, it's literally like two different continents, two different cultures. It's so different, and it definitely is a challenge to sort of like, you know, make one rule that fits everybody and that kind of, you know, goes through all of the different... You know,
well, even just looking at what's going to be grown there, what's manufactured and processed there, right? I'm in the middle in Utah. That's very, it's heavily impacted. You know, our laws and policies are heavily impacted by the church, and so that's another. Like, it really is this whole other entity that we need to consider as far as what is the opportunity and scalability of that industry within those parameters or those rules or laws or.
Or even take geographies. I mean, if you take Utah or if you take the Dust Bowl of Colorado and all the surrounding states, and then you compare that with Florida, well, the same genetics will never flourish in, you know, in these states. Yeah. So if you just let one or two of the genetics pass through the legislation and everything else still remains illegal, you have helped nobody. This industry is not really setting off the floor. And I think education is really at the forefront. I mean, I've had so many conversations. I traveled on my US tour to Georgia, to New York. I was speaking with a lot of colleges. I was in the Savannah College of Art and Design in Atlanta. I was also at the CUNY Law School in New York. And you know what? All of them were interested in hemp for very different reasons. And that already shows that the education that needs to be, I always say, site-specific. It doesn't really matter if I have the sort of global perspective of everything if I can't apply it to what's right or needed at a certain location. So this is really also part of the book, that in all of these different chapters, I really try to make sure that we're kind of like zooming in and out from huge global corporations, such as in China, Hempfortex, huge on the textile industry of hemp, but then also having teeny tiny grassroots projects in Italy, South Tyrol, in Austria. This is the network chapter where you really see it's, you know, teeny tiny players, but then there's also a couple really big players in between, like Saleva, which is a huge outdoor clothing and gear company. And you see how these come together, and actually it's that, I always say, add the energy in a bowl, right? We all need to kind of amplify each other in what we're doing.
Yes, we've got to rise the tide, right? Rising tides raises all boats. And this goes back to what we talked about in the very beginning, the value of the network and the impact that we can make. You know, I'm really proud, and it makes me feel so good. No matter where I travel, I could say, hey, I know somebody in this country, or I can, you know, reach out to somebody within the state and connect for lunch or get together or stay at their house, like you said. But the impact we can make on a community with the exact same product that is as substantial as a huge organization is what's really been eye-opening to me. I understand being in the U.S., this capitalism mindset of, you know, what we're looking for, especially as we're talking about money coming in to build infrastructure and the need. But again, I go back to, you look at these smaller countries that have underserved or less privileged, you know, communities with more problematic land or less equipment. That's where hemp plays a major impact on the health. And that's that baseline that we have to raise. And so I go back to, like, what really makes me feel good is being able to say, for the first time, we have profitability and sustainability, and we can make major impact on small rural communities from housing, fuel, food, shelter, and so forth, right? So pretty exciting.
Definitely. I do want to say something that I've been observing a little bit critical, or at least, let's say,
I like this.
It's alarming me a little bit, because I also see the hemp industry also sometimes going off into these tangents where you see that everybody's suddenly talking about, you know, sustainability, everything, this, that, the other. Yeah. But we're starting to make products and things with hemp that are not necessarily the most sustainable of their purpose. Let's put it this way. I think also the hemp industry needs to be very clear, or at least very honest to itself, and really look into the mirror and say, we have that potential of the plant. The plant is pure, the plant is good. Let's not take this into the next round of making something bad off it just because we're getting, you know, too much taken away by trying to make the big bucks and the big money. I mean, we look at the CBD rush. You guys know much more about that than I do.
But a good example, right, of where poor business decisions were made because we're chasing a rush or chasing this idea of big money and not paying attention to sustainability or the actual need of the people in the industry.
Definitely. And I think we really need to make sure that we align well in, you know, let the plant exist for the good stuff it can do, and don't take it into the next round of, you know, indoor planting, using a whole lot of water, overbreeding the genetics so they become very weak, and, you know, we suddenly also need to start using pesticides and herbicides and all that stuff. Right now, we don't need it. Let's stay that way. Because we humans definitely have a tendency to really come up with a problem to any solution.
Yeah, we overcomplicate it. And this kind of goes back to the need to isolate the CBD or each, you know, individual cannabinoid. It's just, it doesn't make sense when we look at the big picture of, you know, health and wellness and nutrition.
Right. Yes, I will also say that I have a feeling, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but one of the reasons why all this isolation thing is happening is also because we can't really pass the barriers of, you know, legalization, or better saying, all the legislative rules that are on, you know, you can't use THC or you can't this and can't that and can't that. So people start extracting randomly all these individual cannabinoids because
how you patent it, right? You can't patent the whole plant, but you can, I mean, it's in a single isolate or the way at which it's created. And so that's where, I could talk a whole lot about this and get on a tangent and a rant, but I probably won't online, but I would love to chat more about it because it's something that the industry especially is facing or butting up against as we see, you know, big pharma getting involved on those individual isolates and how they're, you know, being processed or utilized. And makes it tricky. But I think this is where I go back to what you just said, or kind of validate what you just said, paying attention to the value of what the plant and what is that value hemp provides to the product we're trying to create or replace or substitute. And this just happened recently. I had a big plastics company that I'm working with looking for a more biosustainable or biodegradable material, a bioplastic. And one of the companies that I reached out to said, you know, I'm really interested and I want to get involved, but I want to be careful my name or our plastic, which is biodegradable, is not listed or labeled on a product that is not actually better for the environment. And so I really appreciated that they took a step back to say, you know, what's more important to me is the health of our planet and upholding why we're doing this versus taking the sale and now producing a product that really isn't any better so that that company can get the brand or the name to move product. And so I am seeing a lot of very ethical companies. And I think that sticking together with that, and this is where network becomes really valuable and important, right? As we support each other, we can link up on deals, we can help promote those that are doing it right. And so with that, and you've met so many people and seen so much over the last couple of years, what want to give a shout out to people that are companies, countries, places that are really doing it right? Who should we be paying attention to besides yourself?
Wow. Well, this is a really big question, and I'm probably...
You're going to miss a lot of people, I know, because anytime you're on the spot...
One of the companies I always have to think about is Trifilon, the biocomposite, and I will say hemp plastic producer in Sweden. Okay. They have, the reason why they fascinated me is because they never came in to do anything from hemp, but they were trying intrinsically to find solutions for lightweight, very heavy duty, you know, durable, and that's how they stumbled over hemp. And they did that at a point where Sweden was still completely contra the whole industrial hemp growing. So they really walked an extra mile, and I really want to give a big shout out to them because they're doing great stuff. Another one who totally blows my mind each and every time again is the German clothing producer HempAge. The CEO, Robert Hertel, he is such an indefinite source of wisdom on anything, you know, industrial hemp on the textile line, which is so phenomenal because I think we all know that the whole textile hemp industry is something that's sort of much talked about and still needs a lot of debunking because there's so many myths stuck with us on the textile stuff. And Robert really debunked so much of these myths for me. And he was one of these mentors that I could constantly call up and be like, Robert, I don't get it. Can you explain that to me again? So there's...
Did I hear this right? Are they speaking English?
Yeah, it's Robert's really a good one. And I, you know, saying a couple of these names, I do want to say a big, big thank you. And I think I have not done that so far on any of the live casts, but a big thank you to absolutely everybody. Also to Her Many Voices, Alicia Fall, who has pretty much just finished a whole big book tour with me through three countries. She came to Latvia, and then she also was here in Amsterdam. And I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who has supported the book, who sponsored the book, those who have given away their stories, who gave me a lot of their time to, you know, basically photograph and do the storytelling to put it in the book. For everybody who's given me their voice and time and brain, it's been a life story or a lifetime story for me the last 6 years. And I really... Yeah, it's, as I said, you always forget somebody when you're trying to call names, but it's,
always. Yeah. That's why I wait and do it with by surprise. No, I'm just kidding. But it really is. It's every time somebody says, hey, who do you want to highlight? It's like, oh my gosh, I have so many. And then I forget. Yeah, I start worrying about who I'm going to forget and forget the people I want to mention. And so I would love to invite any of the speakers, anybody involved that you have met along your journey to come and share their story. I would love to highlight them and give them a voice as well, help support wherever I can. I'd also love to share a link to purchase your book in our newsletter, and so we can make sure all of our members and viewers and listeners have access to it. And then I'd like to talk too. We've got a lot of universities here locally and governments that I would love to utilize this, similar to the way you mentioned, as, you know, ways to explore and educate kind of from a, I find myself sometimes, I mean, I feel like I breathe fire when I talk about hemp. I talk about it all the time. And so it's nice sometimes to be hands off and say, hey, here's another tool and another way to digest the information. And so I definitely will be ordering a couple more because I would like to get them out. Anything else you want to mention before we close up and wrap up for the day?
Maybe for the United States listeners, anybody interested in the book, we actually have the feature of there are still books in the United States, so you can actually order local. I mean, the books are deposited in Denver, Colorado, so local, even at the East or West Coast, might not be as local. But at least these horrendous long shipping times that are usually created when you order anything from Europe, they're cut out. So you know, as soon as you give your United States address into the ordering on the web shop, you will see that the shipping fees are local. So
even better. How exciting. And that's just on your website, is that right?
Yes, you can order over the website. There's the web shop. And I will say that if you give it another week, you will have more options for payment. I know that this was holding back a lot of people because I had only integrated PayPal so far. We're working on that. We're fixing up the shop. If just check back in over the next week and you will probably find more options that are maybe a little bit more handy and convenient for you guys.
Oh, you're awesome. Well, if anybody else has questions, don't hesitate to holler. If you need help getting in touch with anybody that we've had on our show, give me a shout out. And then if you've seen anything that you like on today's show, please subscribe, join our organization. So thank you guys all for listening or chiming in. Other than that, Maren, thank you so much for joining me. Anything else you need, please don't hesitate to reach out. We'd love to support you. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much, Mandy, and thank you to all of our listeners. What you do is so wonderful. Keep on doing it.
Oh, you're awesome. I can't wait to meet again. Talk soon.
Cool. Bye-bye.
Okay, see you later.